Hello and welcome to the Logan Merrick Talks podcast. This podcast is all about hearing some incredible music made by indie musicians and listening to the stories of some pretty incredible people who refuse to live a status quo life. Sit back and relax, and most of all, be inspired. Hello and welcome to the Logan Merrick Talks podcast. As always, I'm so thankful that you're here. Got a great episode lined up for you today. We will not have any music today only because, well, the interview was pretty long, but that's not just the only thing. Dr. Gary Habermas is my guest today. We're talking about near-death experiences. And Dr. Habermas is a well-known apologist. What's an apologist? No, he's not someone that goes around apologizing all the time, anything like that. But apologia is Greek for defense, and so what he does is defends the faith. And he's very well known for his evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You can go out on YouTube and just type in Dr. Gary Habermas and see all the times he talks about. He's been doing it for a long, long time. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And then he's also got a lot of books and things like that. But he's also known for his research on the Shroud of Turin, which I won't get into that, but that's a really amazing thing as well. But he's also very well known for his research in near-death experiences. Now, who is Dr. Gary Habermas? Well, he is the head of philosophy for Liberty University. He is one of the most intelligent men I've ever come across. And I will say this, I am a fanboy. Yes, I am definitely a fan, have been for a very long time. I've got a lot of his books, watched a ton of his videos on YouTube, spent many hours watching him. And so I was pretty geeked out to be interviewing one of the guys that I honestly would hope to do a PhD under one day. But I'm very thankful for Dr. Habermas and the work that he's done for the faith, and just for this, for the chance for him to come on my podcast was amazing, and we had a great time together. I think you're really going to enjoy it. But before we go any further, as always, if you would, wherever you're listening to me, if you have not, would you subscribe to the podcast? Would you leave a rating? Would you tell others about it? That would be awesome. But before we also go any further, before we dive into this interview, I also want to tell you about a sponsor of this podcast is Compassion International. Compassion International helps fight poverty in third world countries, and it helps to bring not only food and education and health care, but also brings Jesus to villages all across the globe. And so if you would like to partner with this podcast and with Compassion International and sponsor a child today, for $38 a month, you can do just that. You can feed, clothe, bring health care and education, but also bring Jesus to this child. So I will have a link on my website or in the show notes of this show if you would like to partner with me and with Compassion International and help fight against poverty. I'm thankful for Compassion International for being a fantastic sponsor of this show, and I'm thankful for you as the listener for being a supporter of it. Also, if you would like to be a producer of this show, that's right, you can help produce the Logan Merrick Talks podcast. You may be wondering how you can do that. Well, you can go over to patreon.com. I'll also have links to that as well and more information about that in another episode, in the Friday episode, of how you can be a sponsor of this podcast. And so thankful again for you guys and what you do and how you listen in every week. But let's go ahead and let's dive into this interview. Again, there will be no music, but I think you're really going to enjoy how we talk about, Dr. Habermas and I, about near-death experiences. How can we trust them, first and foremost? What about this stuff about going to heaven? What about these Christians that have had have these books and have these movies? Can we trust these things? And we talk about all of those things. We talk about heaven. We talk about hell. We talk about the different people that Dr. Habermas has interviewed for a very long time and how we should basically, as Christians, take them. So without further ado, let's go ahead and dive into that interview right now. Well, Dr. Habermas, thanks so much for coming on. And I know that you are well known for many things, but near-death experiences is going to be our topic today. And my first question to you is this, because we read about all of these books in our Christian bookstores and everything. We've seen movies, and you can find people on both sides of the aisle. Some people are very encouraged by these books. Other people would say you should not read those books. What do you say in regards to near-death experiences? What is the healthy response for us as Christians when it comes to near-death experiences, and should we trust them?
Wow. A lot of questions rolled in. Take me a little while to unpack them. I can start, and you can jump back in wherever you want. It's a minefield. There are a number of things to look out for. I can name a few. I'm almost never asked that, but I would be glad to name a few. But I'll tell you what, the other side of the minefield, there's some things to stub your toe on. Okay, so don't run into that tree. But just because there's a tree there doesn't mean you can't walk in the nice soft green grass next to it. And in this case, there's a lot of soft green grass about NDEs. In fact, I would say that in the realm of natural, well, different people are going to call it different things. Natural revelation, natural theology, which would appeal to religion against those who do not believe in religion, but the Buddhist and the Hindu and the Muslim and the Jew would stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian. It is as strong as anyone. I think it would rival intelligent design and fine tuning for the amount of evidence that's available. It is heavy stuff. And so much so that I've noticed over the years, the critiques have started to go down and as the evidence goes up and there's more evidence piling in, not many people saying things. Okay. What are the trees or the stones that you can stub things on? And I'll mix some stuff in here, some phantom trees that when you get close, they're not really trees, they're bushes and you can get around them. Some people think that NDEs are not biblical.
Now, when you say NDEs, we just want to clarify so people understand. Near-death experiences is what that stands for. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. And they're experiences, and they'll say, well, none of them are in the Bible. That's false. But they'll say no experiences like that are in the Bible. They'll say, and the big things they'll say, and these are worth talking about, but why do avowed unbelievers say they went to heaven? Why did avowed unbelievers say they met Jesus and Jesus said they were fine and they were going to come back at the end of their lives and they'd be with him forever? Or why did Jesus say nothing and just hug them like he was their favorite son or daughter? Okay, that's one. A lot of people don't hear hell cases. So they say, oh, that's the typical thing. Hell's put down. What happened to hell? So not biblical. Where's hell? How come we see these good reports from people who will even tell you they're non-Christians? The good things, there are now, at my last count, over 300 evidential cases that tell you that these people are living beyond death. Now, somebody might say, well, yeah, 300 cases, but I don't need the NDEs. I have resurrection, so I don't just have to pile up evidences. And look what you get for the deal. You get unbiblical worldviews, and you get a bunch of stones. I'd rather have a field without the stones. Well, I'll just answer briefly on that and let you move on. What I would say to the why can't we have a nice grassy field like a resurrection field and not have to walk in the NDE field with the stones, I'd say the reason you want NDE stones is because the field with the stones it's fine because we can answer the stones. We can pick them out of the field like a farmer does. A farmer doesn't stop planting because there's rocks in the field. Pulls the rocks out and then plants the field, and we can do that. But why do it if you have a field without rocks? Because the evidence is so good. It gives us another arrow in our quiver to go after those who say, it doesn't prove Christianity's right, but it proves that some kind of religious heritage is right. And those who say there's none, which is supposedly the biggest view today in the universities, the none, that's what's going down for evidence like this.
So just to back up, you said, because, and I hear this all the time, especially just with the type of guys that I follow, is they'll say there is no biblical evidence for near-death experiences, and you said that is false. Can you tell us
where we find evidence for near-death experiences in the Bible.
Okay. First of all, let me just say, they've got to hear a little introduction here, because they might think, well, the things you're saying are in the Bible, the things that you're saying are in the Bible, that doesn't sound like the one where the little Burpo son went to heaven, or other places where people say they were in Jesus' presence, and there's nothing like that in the New Testament. Okay. NDEs, near-death experiences, are called near-death experiences, and there are experiences come, it's like ice cream, it comes in a lot of flavors. And so I would point to the following. When Paul is stoned at Lystra and left for dead, so much so that his disciples came to take his body and bury him, you know, you're pretty sure of who's dead before you put him in the ground. He says in 2 Corinthians 12 that he knew a man, and then he tells you in a few minutes that it's him, a few verses that it's him. He knows a man who went to the third heaven, he says twice, whether out of the body or in the body, I know not which, and I visited heaven. Now, I'm in the middle of my study here, and I have a couple books over on the shelf, I think the Ryrie Study Bible, I'm trying to think, and I think maybe the Unger Bible Handbook. These little tiny things that were out way before NDEs were big things. They say, hey, this could be the same experience that Paul had when he was stoned, because the chronology works out. So that's someone who's just making a comment. So someone could say, well, that's not the Jesus hugging me thing. Well, it's a very wide field. And we have experiences where Paul says, out of the body or in the body, and he went to the third heaven. All right, that's one. How about Stephen, who looks up and sees Jesus standing in the right hand of God? And that's amazing. Or how about a parable? Now, some people don't think it's a parable. That would give it even a little more force, but I think it's a parable. Where in Luke 16, Jesus tells the story of the rich man Lazarus, and this is not the Lazarus who was dead and Jesus raised him. It's another story, same name. And it says, the man who was poor, he died, and he was carried by angels to Abraham's bosom. Now, you know, that sounds like one of those chick tracks from years ago where the angel picks the guy up around the waist and they're kind of supermanning across the heavens. Where does he get that story? Well, it's from Jesus' parable. But Jesus says the angels took him on a process, carried him to another realm, and he's in Abraham's bosom. So there are enough cases for sure that could be. Now, whatever you do with Jesus went and spoke to the spirits in prison, you know, that's entirely different. I understand, but there's life in the intermediate state, and a near-death experience is just that, near death. But the fact that I'm conscious and not soul sleeping, by the way, that helps us too, to go against a doctrine that we disagree with others who hold soul sleep. But it says that consciousness goes on. And John 5:24 says, when we die, we're passed from death unto life. And that's kind of what happens. I mean, death is awful and it's a curse, but we're passed to life. So I think there's enough phenomena to at least make us open up and look. It's like saying, I mean, this isn't true, but it's like saying, oh, I don't see any intelligent design like Bill Dembski or Stephen Meyer talk about in the Bible. I don't see anybody counting DNA and RNA and... Right, but look at this verse, and the heavens declare the glory of God, and what do you do with that kind of design and blah, blah, blah? It's there. It should at least make you look at it.
Right. So tell us about, like, what made you begin to investigate near-death experiences?
Well, let me back up one step. A lot of people ask me, why did I start investigating the resurrection? And I can tell people have been really nice if I'd done that because I wanted to help you and you and you and you and all these doubters. I've had something like 700 conversations with doubters. And I'd like to say I was altruistic and I did it for them. I didn't. I did it for my own doubts. So when I started, I hate to say this, it's a horrible time in my life, but when I started seemingly to me sliding away from Christianity, my friends started throwing things up saying, hey, did you hear this one? Did you hear this one? Did you hear about Secret Josephus or We can now date the creation to this and that and this and that. And what about fulfilled prophecy? Hasn't happened yet, but it looks like it's going down. And I was studying these things, and I thought either zero as far as evidence, or if there was evidence, it was like an archaeological discovery that would back up a passage, but not enough for me to believe in Christianity. It's not big enough. So I settled on the resurrection. But as time went on, of all the things people came to me with and said, do this, do this, do this, there were only two. I might think of another one here, but there were only two that I thought, whoa, this evidence is pretty heavy. And the two are near-death experiences and the Shroud of Turin. They're the two action-packed kind of topics that people really get excited about. And I did work on both of them. Ended up co-authoring two books on the Shroud with fellow who was the spokesman for the scientific team, and he was in the famous carpool of Air Force Academy professors that started studying the Shroud. And then I've written a lot of things on NDEs. NDE is probably the second most, the topic next to the resurrection I did the most research on. So it came from people giving me things to look at and say, check this, check that. And the NDEs came from stories of my own family where people told me, did you ever hear that this guy saw Jesus before he died? Who's that? That's your great uncle. Or that's so-and-so. Then one would just pop up, or my best friend would say, hey, do you know what? My mom died. And she said she was with Jesus just minutes before she died. Or she looked up and said, yes, Jesus. She put her arms out to him and sat up and fell back on the pillow. So people started telling me those things. I just put them back in my mind and go, interesting, make a mental note. Then later I found a lot of evidence.
So just for a second, I want people to know, if you want to know more about the Shroud of Turin, if you're like, what in the world is that? It's super interesting. And Dr. Habermas has a lot of videos on YouTube, which you can just Google Dr. Gary Habermas, and there's going to be a lot of stuff that comes up. But if you want to know more about the Shroud of Turin, one of my favorite things to investigate myself, I would definitely say go on YouTube and watch that. Now, back to the near-death experiences. I, if I'm not mistaken, in one of your videos you talk about your mother-in-law. Is that correct? Was it your mother-in-law or someone like that had a near-death experience, and that kind of was also a springboard, if you will, to these investigations?
I don't remember my mother-in-law having one.
Someone close to you?
There were several people in our family. One, it's not even a woman, but I mean one case of a very, very close friend. His wife came to see him in the hospital and he was dying. And she said, what have you been doing today? And he said, I walked in the hospital garden with Jesus. She said, no way. And no evidence. This is the way a lot of NDEs are. No evidence. But when you look at the person, you see the twinkle in their eye, and you see the way they tell the story, it's like they were with John Wayne. They were with John Wayne for the weekend. You know, they're with their favorite actor. It's just like, man, and he called me by name. And so you can tell it's changed their life, but some of them are evidential. So I have a number I could choose from in my own family. In fact, a nephew whose house I was in Sunday in another state, he was 7 years old, and he had a near-death experience after surgery. And weren't super detailed, but yeah, there's some in my family anyway.
There was a story that you told in one of the videos about a nurse, and that's I guess that's where I'm getting this. But there was a nurse that she was shaking her arm with a watch.
Right.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah. Yeah, a medical doctor we know pretty well. She was doing some procedure. I don't know if it was emergency right there, doing something to the person's heart. The person was having a full-blown heart attack. I don't remember. But she was doing something pretty. This person was going to die. And she was doing it in the emergency room. And she kept putting her arm up in the air and shaking it and putting her hand down. Putting her arm up in the air, shaking it, and putting her hand down. And when the lady, they saved her physically, and she was 80-something years old, I think. And she asked the doctor, why did you keep putting your arm up in the air and shaking it down? And the medical doctor said, I've got this stupid watch that hangs around my hand and comes down to my palm and stops on the edge of my palm. And when I'm trying to save your life, I don't know what that watch was there for. I felt like throwing it away, but it kept coming down, and I shook it down my arm like this so I could keep working on you. And the woman described the process and how she did it and went back to work on her. So she's obviously watching when she's in dire circumstances.
Yeah, so she was somewhere being able to see this happen, even though they know she was fully unconscious and not alive.
They said she was up above her body walking. That was typical indie. She said she was up above her body looking down and watching.
So have you personally interviewed people that have had near-death experiences?
Many.
And so do they talk about heaven at all and what heaven is like?
Many.
So can you?
I'd say there's more common to talk about being up above their body and looking down. Like a woman in my church, here's a good one for you. A woman in my church, during childbirth, she was 15 feet up above her body. At first, they don't recognize it's them. First of all, because people are blocking their face. But secondly, we identify our identity is linked with our, you know, where our thinking's coming from. And my thinking is not coming from that person down there in the bed. It's right here. So she was, as it were, on a stepladder up above the doctors as they delivered the baby. And I said, well, what happened? That's it. I was up there for a little while, and I went shooting back into my body, and here I am today. So was it important in your life? Oh, absolutely. Incredibly important. No evidence. And so why is it important? Because I just know that when I die again, I'm going right back there. Well, you were just up in the air above your body. Yeah, it's a lot more detailed than that. What that told me is there's another realm. And I'm going to be with Jesus. I just know it. I don't have the slightest doubt. You've not doubted? Oh, absolutely not. I was there. So even though no evidence, you could not talk her out of it. And that's really, really typical.
What do some of the books and different things that I've read in regards to near-death experiences, and I'm curious to hear the people that you've interviewed, because I'm getting this secondhand, okay, through books and articles, but they talk about how when they're out of their body, they've never felt more alive. Like their sense of touch is heightened. Like they can almost see through walls. There's just kind of this super crazy, like superhero type to their spirits. Do people talk about that with you as well?
All the time, that too. I can think of an evidential case. No, this wasn't one of my cases, but there's an evidential case on record where a person was up above their, they said they were up above their body. And I guess it was a surgical, you know, who knows what a bunch of surgical rooms look like, but I guess there's 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever, side by side, and there's walls that separate them, and surgeries are going on. And this person was above their body, amused at what was going on here, then decided to, their body kind of drifts a little bit. There's only a few feet over to the wall. And they looked through the wall, and they described a man having his leg amputated. And it actually was going on at that moment while they were out. So now you're starting to get into evidence, and that's one of the better ones, that they're watching the leg amputated, identified it, and they could. Now somebody's going to say, oh, they heard somebody talking about it. Well, okay. Having somebody say, well, I wish I quit screaming next door with the, well, the guy wouldn't be screaming, he'd be out. But if they're saying, I hear this loud talking or whatever through the wall, okay, if that's what moves you and you think that's too close and somebody could have overheard something, how about the one from 5 miles away? You know, because there's those. And there's ones from a lot further than that. There's a couple reports that go very far away. When people are out of their body, they very frequently tend to be attracted to where their family are. So they'll look in on their home. It's not super common, but there's some good evidential cases where people look in on a home or watch friends or, you know, just a variety of things, but it's very evidential.
So when, and I'm setting this up, but I'm curious, and I know that other people are too, but when, just from your experience, though, how do people describe heaven when they describe it?
The kind where even if they don't produce evidence, you're immediately paying attention.
Yep.
And okay, I want to be clear. What I'm going to say next doesn't prove anything.
Well, that's where I was going. That's where I was going with it.
It's a testimony, and it is a beautiful testimony. I mean, let me give you an example. If somebody goes on a mountain retreat for a weekend, and it's their family in a mountain with a stream and trout and fish cooked over the fireplace, somebody won't like that, but somebody also like, you know, something different. But the outdoor kind of scene, that's the typical kind of heaven thing. The grass was so soft. I could run and run and run, and you don't understand. I was never athletic, but I ran like crazy for the longest time. Or I saw this creek, and I couldn't wait to get down there. And one person I talked to said they saw posts in the ground, and on the posts, interestingly enough, were Bible verses just stuck in the field as they were running down the field. But it usually concerns a mountain off in the distance, usually always if it's a pastoral scene, if that's the kind of thing they see. It's almost always water, green grass, beautiful trees. And then what gets you is the way they talk about colors or music. Yeah, and they'll talk like this. They'll say, well, the grass was, well, Logan, I'm sorry, but you're not going to understand. When I say the grass is green, at best you think about your just mowed lawn. That's not what I mean. I mean green, that's, oh, darn. The word green doesn't describe what I saw. The word green is, well, it's not another color. I'm sorry, Logan, I can't get this, but it's the deepest. You want to live there for your whole life. And then there's the water. Oh, my gosh. You talk about shades of blue in certain islands and out there. It was on this little tiny pond, and I saw the most beautiful things, and the fish were jumping in the I know I'm not impressing you. I'm sorry, but I'm telling you what, it made an impression on me. And then somebody will say, I started hearing music. And they'll go, oh, man, you used to be involved with music. I know what you mean. I know what you think when I say music. You think what comes out of a guitar or what comes out of a, oh, who cares? That's not what I heard. It's, what is it? I don't know. I've never heard anything like this. Nothing I've ever heard of. But all I can tell you, Logan, is that I wanted to go back to that grass, trees, water, and music. I can't wait. In fact, it's hard for me to get my mind off it all day long, and it was 5 years ago. That's an example. No evidence. You can just tell they were changed.
Right. And that's, you know, I can't remember what book it was. But they had talked, there were several different people, and they always describe the colors that same way as far as going, I can't explain it, but it's almost as if the colors are alive.
Yeah. And we were part of them.
Right.
We were. C.S. Lewis has an interesting comment. I think it's in his famous sermon, Weight of Glory. And he says, nobody wants to be a light bulb. Nobody wants to be light. But it would be nice to take it into ourselves and be part of it and to share with it. And you know what makes that testimony from Lewis really, really interesting is that Lewis had a near-death experience in World War I. He was in the fields and in France. I think he was in a foxhole or a dugout, a ditch or something like that. But he was wounded and had a near-death experience. And he might actually have been talking about a near-death experience there where he says it would be nice to be drawn into the color. We don't want to be green, but we want to share with green, you know, more than we could share here.
Yeah. Well, so let's kind of pivot here for a minute. So, you know, we've talked about heaven, and I think all of us understand that there's things that the scripture tells us a little bit about it, but there's also things, like you said, like we can't verify those things. We can verify, right. Right. And but we can testify to the hospital stays and things like that, like you've talked about, you know, people getting amputated in another room and being able to see their body and shaking arms with the watch. Those things we can verify. So let's pivot and go to what about the atheist or the Buddhist that says, oh, I saw Jesus and he said, I'm coming right back. Like, what do we do with those stories?
And you know what? For the variety of those stories and how some of the people who do them are just downright unbiblical in their lifestyles, and they will tell you they're unbiblical, and they will tell you they're not Christians. Maybe your listeners are saying, dude, you got to explain a lot to explain this category away. And it is not hard at all. I can say it in a minute. And it goes like this. The same person, let me start by asking the question back. I'll tell you what, Logan, you talk to a lot of people. Let me use you as the example. Would you be bothered if your next door neighbor said, yeah, I'm a Buddhist, and I really think it's true. And someday I think I'm going to be part of Nirvana. Or if you talk to a Jew, as I was reading one today on the plane yesterday, saying, sorry, Christians, you guys have committed adultery. We're right. You're wrong. God's going to prove us, not you. All right. That one might bother you a little bit because, you know, you do believe the Old Testament is the word of God. But when you hear testimonies from people in other religions, especially, let's say, the Buddhist, because it's real experience oriented, you go, okay, well, all right, Bob. Hey, listen, whenever you want to get together and I could tell you about the Lord, I'd like to tell you my side too. And you walk away. But are you, when you go in the house, are you bothered by what the Buddha says? Why not? Or even the Jewish fella. Ultimately, why not? Why aren't you bothered? And what about the fact that the Buddhist testimony is not backed by any evidence whatsoever? Just, I'm right, you're wrong, Logan. You go, yeah, okay. That's the meat of the answer to these NDEs. When I ask for evidential cases, let's think of the two we've already said. What have we said? A doctor in the emergency room shaking her watch down. And the reason she's shaking her watch down is because most people take their watch off. But she was in an emergency room that day, and a person came in, and they had to be tended to right then. And so the shaking watch down is a very odd thing. And the odder the thing, the more likely it'll draw some attention. All right, you got a watch shakedown thing. And the other case was the amputation through the wall that you referred to. That's evidence. But that's an example. The evidence we get, almost without exception, the evidence is always this worldly. The evidence is this worldly. I was with an angel, and the angel told me, I'll stop right there, or I was with my deceased father, and my deceased father told me, and the angel and the father said that my younger brother, who just got married 3 years ago and couldn't have a child, is now pregnant, and I can't wait to tell them. And they tell him, they go, I don't think so. And he asks his wife, and she's not. She goes and has a test, and she's pregnant. Where does that come from? You could get, like, I could imagine a case that's not worldly, but the evidence always involves something that can be checked in this world. The other cases out there, when the Buddha says, oh, Jesus met me and said, I'm saved. All I do is go, really? How do you know it was Jesus? Well, he just really looked like him. Ah, okay. Look like the paintings, right? Yeah. And I just felt it was like him. Okay. What I mean is, yeah, it's a little heavier. It's a little more interesting than the I'm a Buddhist from the guy who lives across the street. But they're testimonies. And if they're not evidential, they're just unevidential testimonies. And I wouldn't put a Christian's up there either. Now, to show you I'm trying to be a good player here, this knife cuts both ways, because about 20% of NDEs are hell experiences. Hell experiences. That's pretty shocking. But I can't use those as evidence of hell. See, the Christians get upset when there's no hell in the cases, but I can't use the ones that do have a hell. Why not? Because they're only testimonies. I was there, and it was horrible. And you know what I'm thinking to myself? Dude, did you grow up in the Bible Belt? Did you hear a lot of heavy hellfire preacher when you're growing up? Did somebody yell at you and always tell you, you're going to hell for running across their lawn? Yeah, I heard stuff like that. Yeah, I could see where some of this might have come from. But there's no evidence they were in hell. I can't count ungrounded testimonies. I can't make my theology out of a Hindu who says they met Jesus or a Hindu who went to hell. So I have to go with the evidential cases. And when I mention the evidential cases, almost always we're talking about this world. So you're not going to be able to, you know, see somebody's leg being amputated and the conclusion can't be, therefore Hinduism's true. Can't go there. But when you say Hinduism's true, maybe you felt you met somebody like an angel and the angel told you Hinduism was true. That's okay. I don't have a photo of the angel. I don't know the angel. There's no evidence there. That's the same thing as you telling me that across the street. You were raised in Hinduism. I expect you to think that. But you know what? I expect the Christian to think he met with you. Oh, you accept the Christian ones. I don't. I listen to him and I go, that is wonderful. And I hope something like that's true. But it doesn't appear in my list of evidences. So it's very easy. Those are just testimonies.
So we come full circle with my first question, which is, so like when we see these books, the Burpo stuff, I Saw God or whatever it is. I don't even know what it is. But when we see these books and these movies, we should kind of take them with a grain of salt, like you're saying, because they are testimonies as opposed to evidential things that we can actually look at and be able to measure and verify.
Yeah. And when you can, that's great. Now, many times, like I told you about the woman who I know who was up above her body while she was having a baby, and she said, I'll never be the same, but she changed my whole life. Okay, what can I tell? Number one, it's changed her life. I can hear her testimony. It's changed her life. She's not afraid to die. She even has a secret longing. She doesn't want to leave her family, but that time comes, she's ready. She hadn't even seen her baby yet, and she was ready. I can take her testimony as a nice testimony, and I can learn and I can grow, but it doesn't meet my, you're right, it doesn't meet my standards. And I get pretty strict about what evidence is. I'll use the amputee case. I mentioned it today, but I understand the comment that says maybe somebody in the room, in their room, was talking about the amputee going on over the wall and they heard it. I understand. I think it's a real long shot. But what do you do with the one that describes what went on in the room two floors away while your family was gathered, what they were saying about you, that you never heard anybody say about you before while you were being operated on? That's more evidential. So that's what I go for. And all that's this worldly. I can't evidence testimonies alone, and I definitely can't build a worldview because somebody feels like X is true. And that includes Christianity. I don't say Christianity's true because a Christian had a near-death experience.
Yeah. Well, one last question for you. Is, do you ever come away from these near-death experience when you're talking to these people? Do you ever come away encouraged or just feeling like I'm encouraged by that? Or I don't know, like what is the typical feeling? Yeah. Do you come away excited about things?
Absolutely, I do come away excited, and I do turn this around. If I'm a church, or if I'm in an I'm not an alcoholic, never drink. But if I knew somebody was an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting and a Hindu gave a testimony of, I applied these steps and I'm no longer a drunkard and I'm reunited with my family, you're going to be affected. We're affected by buoyant. And then again, if somebody says, golly, I thought I was good until I went to hell, and then no evidence, but you sit there and you're horrified like everybody else, but you walk away and you go, I don't have any reason to think it's true. What I mean is, we are affected by testimonies, but being affected by news and being comforted, since I know Christianity is true and my evidential arrow quiver is full. I use 10 different evidences, 4 for religion in general that say naturalism is wrong, and 6 for Christianity in particular, of which NDEs is one of the first category, general ones that don't say Christianity is true but say religion is true. I keep those. So I keep all kinds of testimonies and studies, but I can only really use the evidential ones before I can go blast it out there and talk about evidence for people. I have to be brought back to near-death experience, to the evidential near-death experiences.
So whenever you, you know, naturalism is a thing that's dying, as I've heard you say many times, and I just see it in the more that we is near-death experiences part of that worldview kind of going away.
I hope so. I'll tell you a couple things I've heard going down. And you go, well, there you go again, testimony. No, these are reports from unbelievers and what they say about the state of the evidence. And that's a different kind of category.
Before you get started, define just for people in layman's terms what naturalism is, just in case there's people out there that don't know.
Naturalism is the predominant Western worldview taught in places like our universities, most significantly. It's in the Western world, so it's going to be North America, at least Northern Europe, probably a good part of Southern Europe. You're probably going to find it in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, maybe a good part of South Africa. And it believes the folks who are naturalists, just like the word applies, they think above all whatever else they think, that the natural world is all there is. And you usually learn about the natural world by sense experience. So they elevate sense experience. But the chief thing is, by definition, there's no supernatural. And when they give arguments, the table is so slanted against religion that they'll sit there and go, come on, Logan, talk to me. How many evidence do you have? Well, I have four evidences. Give them to me. Give them to me. Well, you know, those things don't happen. Those things don't happen. Those things don't happen. And we hear this so much where we think to ourselves, golly, what is the good evidence for religion? But it doesn't even occur to us till you're walking away and your friend says, that dude never gave any evidence for his position. He tilted the table against us, telling us there's no evidence for anything. And he says more than there's no evidence for you. He says naturalism is true and we see it all around us. If he even says that, that's the closest he comes to evidence. In fact, I debated a year or two ago, one of the top naturalistic philosophers of science in the world. And the discussion was, is there any evidence for atheism? And we started with a bang and said there was no evidence for atheism and no evidence for naturalism. Two blows right off the bat. And at the end of the discussion, to my remembrance, no evidence was produced for atheism and no evidence was produced for naturalism. The person just took the view. And yet it was the be-all, end-all proof against everything else. And they kept asking, where's your evidence? Where's your evidence? Where's your evidence? Where's your evidence? And they gave none.
Anthony Flew being the one of the most well-known atheist naturalists. And at the end of his life.
Wow.
And he ultimately said, yeah, no, there is a God. I don't know that he ever became a Christian, but
he knew salvation. He knew what it was, what he did in the wee small hours of the morning when he was alone with God. I can't tell you. His dad was an evangelical pastor. But, we don't know what people do. And Anthony Flew gave three reasons for becoming a theist. His number one reason were the metaphysics of Aristotle, starting with questions like, why is there something rather than nothing in the universe? So number one, metaphysical type arguments. Number two, intelligent design, which everybody told him he was nuts, and he was one of the bold unbelievers who said there's a lot to intelligent design. And three, an intriguing question, why are there laws of nature? If this came from a big bang and it was total chaos, why are there laws of nature? Why is 2 plus 2 always equal 4? Why are there always laws of gravity and MC squared, and why? In a chaotic universe, it would be more like the Matrix. Why is it organized? So those were three big issues for him. But the things I was going to tell you, when you said, are there signs things are changing, then you had me give that definition of naturalism. Well, that's all right. A good friend, I just don't know if he wants this all over the airwaves right now, but this guy is as well-known a physicist as anybody to the Christian world today, great degree in physics. He told me, and the guy reads like crazy, and the guy tells me that in the last 3 years, I think it is, someone's finally going to tell me, oh, it's in his latest book, and it could be, but he tells me he's not read a cosmologist in the last 3 years who doesn't say, I've changed my view to deism, or I'm at least open to it. That's amazing. Including, I don't want to mention the name again because it might have been a, you know, just a friendly conversation with me. But I said, how about so-and-so? And I mentioned probably one of the top two or three biggest names right now. It's not Dawkins, but one of the top two or three biggest named physicists today. And he said, yep. He said he just said he was open to deism. And I said, you are kidding. And, of course, there's Anthony Flew. There's others. So, number one, that field's changing. And now another one of the world's best-known atheists has recently said that it appears that there's an afterlife. You tell me where that's coming from. Why does it appear there's an afterlife? Was it the resurrection or was it NDEs? I'd be really happy if it were resurrection. I got a feeling it's NDEs. So the walls are cracking, and I don't know that last point I made. I don't know what it was, but and the person did actually say, I believe it. But they basically seem to be saying they believed it. I'm trying to be real careful with their words, but things are changing. People are challenged by the data.
Well, and I just want to encourage our Christian brothers and sisters that are listening, like you pointed out, the naturalist always wants to be on the offensive to put you on the defensive because they don't want to be put on the defensive because they don't have answers. And we have plenty.
That could be. No, what I mean by that is you're right. But I wonder if they're really putting you on the offensive because they don't have answers. I think they're not even aware they don't have answers. I think they assume they have answers. And they don't keep talking because they're afraid you're going to step in the gap, I think. I think they don't know. They're the emperor who doesn't know they're not wearing clothes.
I think you're right for a college professor or someone like that. But I think for college students that just get this indoctrination, they continue to talk because I think in the end, when you begin to ask them questions, they have no answers for it.
Well, that's true. When you go on the offensive, look out. Now, when you use resurrection, you know what they're going to say. Miracles don't happen. I've never seen a supernatural event. Well, those aren't refutations. Miracles don't happen. Excuse me. Let's stop right there. How do we know? Because there's no evidential ones. Well, I'll tell you what. I was with Lee Strobel last weekend in Seattle, and we were at a conference, and we were two of the plenary speakers, and he was talking about his new book, in The Case for Miracles, and he gave two cases that were incredible. And, you know, there's got to be a time, if a person is going to be honest, and they keep saying, show me the evidence, show me the evidence, show me the evidence, show me the evidence, and you do, and they keep saying, not good enough, not good enough, not good enough, there's a day when the walls are going to come in, and some bright ones are going to say, we can't just blow all this away by saying, you got nothing, you got nothing, you got nothing. I mean, the Craig Keener 2-volume book, Miracles, I'm looking at it on my shelf. It's already become a classic. But Craig doesn't think apologetically. Craig just puts them out there. And a lot of them are hearsay. Most of them are hearsay. And Craig will say, no, Craig quite well. I think he'd say, yeah, they are. But I'm just giving testimonies. I'm just telling you the testimonies out there because David Hume said, basically, he said the only kind of testimony is all the testimonies against miracles. And Craig saying, opens his book with Hume and says, not so. He doesn't even know how many miracles are in those two volumes, how many recorded there. I don't know. It could be 1,000 or 1,500. Some of them are absolutely amazing cases. But a few that Lee gave this last weekend, I've been reading miracles for a long time. I knew both cases, by the way. I knew both cases. And actually, I was sitting next to Doug Guyvet, my good buddy, and I said, I know this case. And then Lee started the second story, and I said, I know this case. But I hadn't heard the follow-up. And the follow-up was the evidence that totally weights the miracle as you've got to bend over backwards to refuse these things. So, I mean, yeah, it just – there's a lot of arrows in our quiver, and miracles is one of them.
Yeah, I always have to laugh because I actually saw, I never get into Facebook debates when it comes to faith and stuff because it's just endless. But I was watching this atheist guy go to town, and one of the Christians brought up Lee Strobel's book Miracles, and he's like, there is no miracles, blah 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 blah. And it's like Frank Turek says in all his debates, if I show you enough evidence, will you believe it? And 9 times out of 10, they always say, no, I'm still not going to believe it. And it just goes to show you their closed-mindedness and their hard-heartedness. So,
I can show you studies. The main reason, it cuts both ways. Christians believe because Anthony Flew said this to me one day. He said, I never liked the atheists who say Christianity is a crutch. Christianity is the opiate of the people. He says, yeah, people believe because they want to. He said, doesn't it occur to these atheists that people don't believe because they don't want to? And that's Tony Flew. At that time, I got to stop here and think. 20 years before he was converted, before he became a theist, 20 years, he said, that knife cuts both ways. Of course atheists don't believe because they don't want to. So why do they set up this false deal? Oh, no, I believe because of reason. You're the idiot. And the other one, table slanting so that everything comes down in your lap and nothing touches them. But they go, evidence, 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 evidence. And they don't have enough to prove. They just don't have it. They don't have a case. So,
Dr. Habermas, thank you so much for your time. I could sit here and talk forever, but I know you're a busy guy. And if people want to get your books or your, you know, if they would like to see you speak or whatever, where can they go? Like, just throw out the books that you have. And
you mean book titles?
Yeah, I mean,
they'd have to get them from Amazon or something like that, because my website is GaryHabermas.com. So that's HABERMAS, Gary. It's not case sensitive. There's no dots, periods, dashes. And there's a lot of stuff on there for them to read.
There's a free download of the resurrection defense. There was.
Right. There's 4 books that are free downloaded. 2 are ebooks. One of them is comparing Jesus to the founders of the other world religions, arguing. I can make the statement and not back it up, but the book argues that Christianity is basically the only religion in the world that, while everybody does negative apologetics, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, nobody but Christians have good arguments for their positive arguments that would establish their worldview. I argue that for the book, and I do it by arguing more than a half dozen areas where Jesus is unique. The other book is Jesus and the Earliest Evidence, the Creedal Evidence for the Resurrection. And then I have 2 books on doubt. 2 of my 3 books on doubt are under the doubt tab on the left, and all of those books are free. My only point was I don't sell anything, so they'll have to go to Amazon or wherever they go to buy books. But I have over 40 of them. And that's an edited book with Doug Guyvett. And it is answering, it's with, at the time when that book came out, were the hottest evangelical philosophers. Only one guy in the book's not a philosopher, and there's a reason for that. But all the guys in the book are philosophers. And we're going after the main objections against miracles, not giving evidence. Well, we do give some evidence, but there's plenty of evidence. But there's that book. And of all the books I have, I'd say the best-selling ones are The Case for the Resurrection. Well, what I'm saying about best-selling is there must be a reason people are buying these. But The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, that I co-authored with Mike Lacona, and The Historical Jesus, of which I'm the sole author. The first one is Kriegel. The second one is College Press. And then years ago, it's still in print, but years ago, a big seller with our topic today was a book I co-authored with J.P. Moreland. It changed titles. It was Immortality, but it changed to Beyond Death. And it is Exploring the Evidence for Immortality is what the subtitle says. So they're probably the ones. Oh, the Shroud book was a bestseller, but the first Shroud book, Verdict on the Shroud, but that's, you know, that's a topic that's newsworthy and, you know, passes off and on as time goes on. It's back in the news again now, so.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Abames, thank you so much for your time, and I will continue to stay a fan and continue to watch many of your YouTube videos as you continue to put them out, but thanks again for your time and all the work you've put into helping to defend the faith and teach people like myself and others. So thank you.
Logan, I appreciate it. It's about, I'm into this ministry value. I don't do it because it makes you rich or, like I said, I don't put my books on my website. It's all for making people think. Greg Kokel is a great friend of mine, and I love what he says to his listeners. He'll say, I'm not trying to convert you. I'm just trying to put a stone in your shoe. I want you to go away with something to think about. And I hope we gave a lot of somethings for people to consider.
Amen. Well, thanks so much again for your time. We'll chat at you later on.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Gary Habermas. Definitely, I highly, highly suggest going and getting one of his books, and or at least going and watching his YouTube videos, because as you can tell, he's a super intelligent man, and just to hear his stuff on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus will blow your mind. But thank you guys so much for tuning in and for listening. And if you would, as always, like I say at the beginning, please subscribe if you haven't already. Leave a review. Tell your friends about it. But thank you guys so much for supporting this podcast. I'll see you next time, actually on Friday for an All Music Friday, where I'm interviewing EQ Worship, one of my favorite bands that we play right here on the Logan Merrick Talks podcast. Peace out.
She started it, all right? Because she was like, I hate my job. I'm going to burn this mother...